Welcome to Lyric Opera of Chicago's commentary on CD for Dr. Atomic by John Adams. I'm Jesse Graham, Audience Education Manager at Lyric Opera and editor of the Lyric Season Companion. The wonderful music you just heard was a setting of the poem Wild Nights by Emily Dickinson. It's the third movement of Harmonium, John Adams' first major work for voices and orchestra, performed here by the San Francisco Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by John Adams himself. Dr. Atomic was commissioned by the San Francisco Opera and premiered there on October 1st, 2005. Since it's such a new work, no recording of it has been made yet, so we're going to listen to examples from some of Adams' other works that I hope will whet your appetite and pique your curiosity. But first, let's take a look at Adams himself. John Coolidge Adams was born February 15, 1947, in Worcester, Massachusetts. His mother sang in big bands and in musical theater, and his father was a big band clarinetist. Naturally, Adams grew up a fan of Benny Goodman, and he still cites Duke Ellington as a major influence. He played clarinet, studying at first with his father. He must have been pretty good because when he was in college, he subbed with the Boston Symphony. But becoming a composer was on his mind from the time he was only 5 or 6, and he wrote his first pieces when he was 10. For college, he went to Harvard and earned both his bachelor's and his master's degrees there in the late 60s and early 70s. But the conservative atmosphere at Harvard bothered him, and he began to question the academic attitude toward modern music. New music at that time tended to be pretty heady and abstract stuff. And he began to wonder where the point was in performances that were so inaccessible that nobody but other academics could possibly understand them. So he went to California. In 1971, he loaded up his Volkswagen Bug and headed for San Francisco to find himself as a composer. By 1972, he'd landed a position at the San Francisco Conservatory, and soon his work attracted the attention of Edo DeVart, the conductor of the San Francisco Symphony. Adams became the orchestra's new music advisor in 1979, and from 1982 to 85 served as its first composer in residence. It was DeVart who suggested he write something for chorus and orchestra. The result was Harmonium, a part of which you just heard. That was 1980. By 1985, Nonesuch Records, famous for its new music recordings, had signed him on. Since then, he's won 2 Grammys. Festivals of his music have been held in London, Rotterdam, Stockholm, and at the Lincoln Center. And the organizations that have commissioned works from him are too numerous to name. He also won the Pulitzer Prize and 3 more Grammys for his piece On the Transmigration of Souls, commissioned by the New York Philharmonic in commemoration of 9/11. But let's go back to Harmonium. Harmonium made a big impression on Robert Hurwitz, the president of Nonesuch Records. His observations about the piece pretty much hit the nail on the head when it comes to describing what Adams' music is all about. And I quote, "Harmonium was tonal, purposefully and willfully tonal, and in that respect sounded on the surface like so much of the great classical music we have all grown up with. It was accessible. Its form and its language were familiar. But while it was familiar, I was also aware that, one, it could not have been written in any time but now, and, far more significantly, that, two, it was original," unquote. In short, Adams's work is thoroughly modern and fresh, but not excruciatingly dissonant or perplexing. Let's listen to some more of Harmonium. This is an excerpt from the first movement. It's titled Negative Love, a setting of the poem by John Donne. By coincidence, there's a Donne poem setting in Dr. Atomic, but we'll get to that in a few minutes.
Thank you.
I think Hurwitz's evoking the great classical music we've all grown up with is an important point. In San Francisco in the 70s, Adams organized lively concerts of avant-garde music by various composers on the scene. But the end of the night frequently found him musically unsatisfied, writes Adams. I began to notice that often after an avant-garde event, I would drive home alone, lock the door, and, like a closet tippler, end the evening deep in a Beethoven quartet. Now that's a telling confession. The 60s and 70s were wild, experimental times in the new music scene. Composers had been performing their pieces on objects they'd found in junkyards, or creating completely aleatoric music by tossing dice, or exploring new sound worlds with synthesizers, tape loops, and other electronic techniques. Far out stuff, some of it. And though Adams was an active participant in this scene, he turned to the classics for musical nourishment as well. This respect for the classics, combined with an interest in the new and original, gives us a sense of where Adams is really coming from as a modern composer. Compositionally, he's drawing from a deep well. He's got his fingers in a lot of different musical pies. One of those pies is minimalism, which he recognized as a style that would allow him a means of expression that embraced both sides of his musical psyche, the modern and the traditional. Minimalist music is made up of a lot of the same elements that most of us find comforting in traditional classical music. Its hallmarks are a steady regular beat, melodic and rhythmic elements that repeat and become familiar, though critics of minimalism would say that the repetitive elements just go on and 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 on again and 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 again forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. This is kind of a cheap shot, but if you've ever heard a pure minimalist work, whether you liked it or not, you have to agree that pattern repetition is a defining characteristic. But the characteristic of minimalism that made it really stand out in the musical climate of its day was that unlike almost everything else that was being written and taken seriously at that time, minimalist music was tonal, meaning that the melodic lines were based on good old do-re-mi scales and the harmony was based on good old major and minor chords. When a modern piece is tonal, it raises the comfort level of the audience like nothing else can because, let's face it, most of the music that audiences know and love is composed in the operating system of tonality. Adams continues to be keenly aware of this fact. Accessibility is his credo. Sometime in the early 1980s, stage director Peter Sellers heard the music of John Adams for the first time. Here's how he described it. You could feel the electricity in the air instantly. You could feel the fantastic way in which the sense of drama was heightened in the entire room. And you could feel this music move into these waves of energy that just began to break, and the waves got larger and larger and larger, and you knew you were in the presence of a dramatic composer. No question, this is an opera composer. The piece Sellers was talking about was a four-movement suite for strings called Shaker Loops. Here's a little of the first movement. It's called Shaking and Trembling. Thank you. Shaker Loops was conceived in the late 70s, when Adams first embraced the minimalist style. When I listen to Shaker Loops, it reminds me that music, in the most abstract sense, is a lot like sculpture. But instead of occupying space like a statue does, a piece of music occupies time. The composer is a manipulator not of metal, stone, or clay, but of the period of time during which the music is playing. Let's listen to the entire last movement of Shaker Loops, a little bit less than 4 minutes of music, and see if you don't get a feeling of the sculptor's shaping and forming of this piece as it flows by. It's called A Final Shaking. So after he heard this, Sellers walked up to Adams, introduced himself, and told him he wanted him to write an opera. It was the beginning of a long and fruitful collaboration that so far has produced the operas Nixon in China in 1987, The Death of Klinghoffer in 1991, in 1995 a, quote, song play for seven singers and a rock band inspired by the Northridge earthquake of 1994. It's called I Was Looking at the Ceiling, and then I saw the sky. In 2000, a, quote, nativity oratorio called El Niño that can also be staged as an opera, the opera Dr. Atomic in 2005, and in 2006, a second opera oratorio called A Flowering Tree, inspired by Mozart's The Magic Flute. Seller's role of director expanded to include producing the libretti, starting with El Niño and including Dr. Atomic. But first, about the music of Dr. Atomic. After all this talk of minimalism, and in spite of Adams's reputation as a minimalist composer, I don't think that anyone who's heard Dr. Atomic would identify it as a minimalist opera. I saw an interview in which Adams laughingly called himself an uncomfortable minimalist. Perhaps his discomfort is caused by the fact that minimalism is only a sort of compositional workhorse for him, but not by any means the only thing he's interested in doing. Sellers says that the music of Dr. Atomic is overwhelmingly different from that of Adams's earlier operas, and it is, but also it isn't. There are things in Adams's previous two big operas, Nixon in China and The Death of Klinghoffer, that hint at what's to come musically in Dr. Atomic, and that certainly give you an idea of Adams's vocal treatment. Let's start by listening to three excerpts from Nixon in China. Vocal line is what we're listening for here, but it's also interesting to note the minimalist traits of the accompaniment. It's very consonant, it's pulsating and repetitive, and the chord changes are mostly slowly paced. Here's the wife of Mao Zedong singing, I am the wife of Mao Zedong. Trudy Ellen Craney is the soprano with the Orchestra of St. Luke's under Ado de Vart. In this next excerpt, Nixon relates one of his experiences during World War II, and his wife Pat reminisces along with him. Again, pay special attention to how Adams sets the text and the vocal lines. That's the common stylistic thread that ties this opera to Klinghoffer and to Dr. Atomic. James Maddalena is Nixon, and Carol Ann Page is Pat.
A cloud of steam rose from the base, just like a Roman sacrifice.
Never thought
he'd
come back.
I felt so weak. I felt so weak with disappointment and relief. Everything seemed larger than life.
Now listen to what happens when Adams slows everything down. Here's Joanne Lye's aria near the end of the opera. It's sad, pensive, introspective. This is baritone Sanford Sylvan. Now let's listen to a few things from The Death of Klinghoffer, premiered just 4 years after Nixon in China. In this first excerpt, the terrorists have just taken over the Achille Lauro cruise ship, and one of them is giving orders. Listen to the panic and the strings, and note that though the accompaniment has that minimalist repetitiveness, the patterns and sonorities change more rapidly here, and harmony is, I think, appropriately dissonant considering the action. The tenor is Thomas Young. Here's a chorus that sounds stylistically similar to the music of Nixon in China, but notice how Adams uses some of the voices as if they were instruments in the accompaniment. He uses this technique even more in Dr. Atomic. This is the Night Chorus from Act I, performed by the London Opera Chorus and the orchestra of the Opera de Lyon under Kent Nagano. Later in Act I is a chorus of a very different flavor. This is the chorus of Hagar and the Angel. The next selection is Klinghoffer, confronting one of the terrorists. This is one spot of many in The Death of Klinghoffer where you can tell that minimalism isn't Adams's only game. This is different. Missing here is the throbbing pulsation in the accompaniment, and the harmonic changes happen at a pace that's more like what we're used to in the classics. Leon Klinghoffer is sung here by Sanford Sylvan.
never been a violent man. Ask anyone. I'm a person who just as soon avoid trouble. But somebody's got to tell you the truth. I came here with my wife. We both have tried to live good lives. We give gladly, receive gratefully, love, and take pleasure in small things, suffer and comfort each other. We're human. We are the kind of people you like to kill.
And finally, listen to this haunting aria sung from the perspective of Klinghoffer's body after he's been killed and thrown overboard. Besides being so moving, it's amazing how this music transmits such a sense of suspended time, isn't it? Dr. Atomic's music could be described as a giant stylistic step further in the direction you can hear the death of Klinghoffer taking after Nixon and China. One fascinating development that Dr. Atomic brings to the opera stage is the incorporation of a relatively new discipline called sound design. Any performance of Dr. Atomic calls for the use of dozens of microphones, both on the stage and in the orchestra, and over 70 speakers have to be precisely distributed throughout the opera house. Thinking of this setup in terms of simple amplification is like comparing a desk lamp to the laser beam that's reading this CD. The microphones and speakers are not added on to make things louder, but were written into Dr. Atomic from the very beginning as an integral part of the piece. The subject matter of Dr. Atomic is a big topic. It's an opera about the Manhattan Project and its director, physicist Robert Oppenheimer. Most of the action takes place during the hours preceding the July 16, 1945 detonation of the world's first atomic bomb. The Trinity test in Alamogordo, New Mexico, was one of the defining moments in the history of mankind. To fully appreciate the drama of this work, it helps to be reminded of the history that it's based on. The Manhattan Project was a gargantuan endeavor. Good or bad, the task of designing and constructing the first atomic bomb, especially taking into account the labor, resources, speed, and secrecy involved, represents one of the most remarkable and ambitious achievements of humankind. Here's how it started. In the late 1930s, nuclear fission was discovered in Germany. Now, you physicists listening, please forgive me if I'm fudging on the details here. But what that means is that it was discovered that it's possible to split the atom, thus releasing its latent energy to the tune of Einstein's famous formula, E equals mc squared. That is, energy equals mass times c, which is the speed of light, squared. And since the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second, that's a lot of bang for the buck. The theory soon followed that if it were possible to split one atom, then under the right circumstances, it might be possible for some of the resulting fragments to crash into surrounding atoms and split them too. And then those splits would split still more atoms in an ever-increasing chain reaction. When this chain reaction is slow and controlled, you can get enough energy to make steam and generate electricity, like in a nuclear power plant. But with the right materials under the right conditions, the chain reaction could be made to happen very, very quickly, and the amount of energy released would be explosive, a bomb of mind-boggling power. Fearing that the Nazis might gain this technology and use it to take over the world, the U.S. government established the super-secret Manhattan Project to do it first. Early in the project, a group of eminent physicists under the leadership of Enrico Fermi achieved the first controlled nuclear chain reaction right here at the University of Chicago, proving that the theory was true. But achieving a fast, explosive chain reaction was much harder to do. It took huge new industrial facilities, thousands of workers, a significant portion of the United States' total electrical output, and several years just to refine enough of the right kind of fissionable material to fuel the three bombs the Manhattan Project eventually produced. And it took the efforts of thousands of scientists and technicians living in the remote, top-secret city of Los Alamos, New Mexico, to figure out how to make it work. The whole effort was bigger than the U.S. auto industry, and it was so secret that not even Vice President Truman knew it existed. To run the Manhattan Project, the government appointed General Leslie R. Groves, a man of brilliant organizational ability and ruthless determination. But it was the man General Groves appointed to lead the scientific end of the project who would later be recognized as Dr. Atomic, the father of the atomic bomb. J. Robert Oppenheimer seemed an unlikely choice. He was enigmatic and quirky, not even counting his trademark pork pie hat. And he was totally inexperienced as an administrator. Even worse, his past was filled with direct and indirect ties to the Communist Party, ties that would later doom him during the McCarthy era, in spite of his invaluable and unquestionable contribution to the war effort. But the obvious thing he had going for him was his unmatched brilliance as a physicist and an intellectual. He studied at Harvard and in Europe, where he had been at the forefront of the new quantum theory. He was on the faculties of the University of California, Berkeley, and Caltech at the same time. He spoke at least six languages, and he was well-versed in dozens of subjects other than physics. And in spite of his quirks, he was powerfully charismatic. Tall and rail-thin, his blue-eyed gaze could stop anyone in their tracks. There were those who disliked him, but those who loved him were utterly devoted to him. And every source I read about him mentioned that he made the most delicious and potent martinis in the world. Oppenheimer had the formidable intelligence necessary to not only lead a groundbreaking scientific effort, but to quickly pick up the necessary administrative skills as well. He also had the deep sensitivity and perceptiveness needed to galvanize the hundreds of powerful personalities and intellects who were gathered there and to keep them working together efficiently and relatively harmoniously, in spite of the intense psychological pressures and the physical and emotional hardships inherent in living in a top-secret city in the wilderness. After the war, Oppenheimer became one of the most vocal and influential scientists speaking out against the arms race. He also lobbied against the development of the hydrogen superbomb, his colleague Edward Teller's pet project. But Oppenheimer's views fell on deaf ears, and in 1954, less than 10 years after the successful outcome of the Manhattan Project, he was deemed to be a security risk, which formally severed his connection to the government and nuclear policymaking. Edward Teller was among those who testified against him. If you're like me, you might be expecting an opera about the Manhattan Project to be a sort of suspense thriller dealing with a lot of technology and spies. General Groves does mention that he's worried about certain scientists whose loyalties are suspect. And here and there, there's a line or two of jargon that you don't usually hear in an opera. For instance, We surround the plutonium core from 32 points spaced equally around its surface. The 32 points are the centers of the 20 triangular faces of an icosahedron, interwoven with the 12 pentagonal faces of a dodecahedron. Sexy stuff, huh? But what this opera is really about are the political, moral, and ethical issues of the bomb, and how the people building it dealt with those issues. By the time the opera begins, which is June of 1945, the Manhattan Project scientists have spent years trying to find a way to control and harness the basic power of the universe while under the terrifying threat of the Nazis beating them to it. Now the Nazi threat is over, but the project has gone so far and gained so much momentum that the scientists are beginning to realize that they're losing control of their creation. Many are questioning the morality of using the bomb against Japan. The characters are Oppenheimer and Groves, both baritones. Oppenheimer's foil in the opera, and arguably his nemesis in history, is physicist Edward Teller, the gruff, dark-natured man who would later spearhead the development of the hydrogen superbomb. Teller is a bass. Tenor Robert Wilson is a young physicist who's opposed to using the bomb in a surprise attack. The real Wilson would later run Fermilab here in Chicago. And there's also the chief weatherman, Frank Hubbard, who's another baritone, and an army physician, Captain James Nolan, a tenor. Playing in opposition to the male physicists and the world of war and science are two women. Kitty, a lyric mezzo, is Oppenheimer's wife and the mother of their two small children. And Pasqualita, a contralto, is the nursemaid of the Oppenheimer's children. Kitty is described as a Cassandra-like figure by Peter Sellers. She's strong, intelligent, but has a prescience that falls on deaf ears. Pasqualita is Native American. Los Alamos was built in an area that had been inhabited for centuries by ancient tribes, and their descendants became the nursemaids and custodians of the secret community. Two totally different cultures and spiritualities worked side by side during the creation of the bomb. Pasqualita embodies the ancient realm of the earth and nature in juxtaposition with the new world of science and the atomic bomb. Peter Sellers' libretto is an unusual one. It's mostly a compilation of text quoted from period sources such as personal memoirs, recorded interviews, technical manuals of nuclear physics, and declassified government documents. Except for the arias, a lot of what the characters say in Dr. Atomic is exactly what they said in 1945. Then the arias, ensembles, and choruses are settings of absolutely beautiful text by the 19th century French poet Charles Baudelaire, the 17th century English metaphysical poet John Donne, the 20th century American poet Muriel Rukeyser, traditional Native American songs and stories, and even the ancient Hindu text, the Bhagavad Gita. The overture begins with about 2 minutes of what in the score is called a soundscape to draw you into the time and the situation. Adams composed this soundscape by compiling sounds that tie into the drama and then electronically manipulating them. The sounds he uses are heavy industrial machinery, bombers in flight, rain, thunder, ambient street noise, and 1940s radio broadcasts. Toward the end of this opening, you'll hear about 15 seconds of Joe Stafford singing The Things We Did Last Summer, which was a hit in 1946, following the summer of the Trinity test and the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. After the soundscape, the orchestra comes in with a heavy, dissonant chord punctuated by pounding percussion, a fittingly shocking outpouring for the subject of this opera. The tension in the orchestra gradually eases, and the second half of the overture is a very quiet chorus. Matter can be neither created nor destroyed, but only altered in form. Energy can be neither created nor destroyed, but only altered in form. After the premiere in San Francisco, there was a little controversy over these opening lines because some people said they weren't strictly accurate scientifically. It'll be fun to see what's changed for our performances. Scene one begins with a frenzy of activity in the orchestra and on stage, We're in Los Alamos. The chorus, scientists, lab technicians, military people, and the like, describes the basics of the situation. It's June 1945. They're ready to test the bomb. They're not sure when the test will happen or just how powerful it will be, but they do know that the bomb will be a treacherously dangerous new weapon. The chorus closes with the lines, "This weapon has been created not by the devilish inspiration of some warped genius, but by the arduous labor of thousands of normal men and women working for the safety of their country." This is quoted verbatim from a 1945 government report. The chorus gets back to work, and Teller and Oppenheimer enter. Teller's first line is a quote from his memoirs. "First of all, let me say that I have no hope of clearing my conscience. The things we are working on are so terrible that no amount of protesting or fiddling with politics will save our souls." He and Oppenheimer discuss technical problems they're encountering with the Gadget. Gadget is the code name for the bomb. Teller apologizes for his rudeness in project meetings. Oppenheimer eases him off the hook by telling him he can just report to him in private. Teller shows Oppenheimer a letter he received from his friend Leo Szilard. Szilard was a physicist who composed the famous letter to the president, signed by Einstein, warning him about the possibility of atomic bomb development. When the Nazis were defeated, Szilard sent a second letter and a petition from the atomic scientists protesting the government's plans for the use of atomic power. Oppenheimer objects to the idea of scientists getting involved in politics. Robert Wilson is there, and he pipes up that he's organizing a meeting of the scientists to discuss the impact of the gadget on civilization. Wilson begins reading the petition. The text quotes Szilard's actual petition, but Teller interrupts, saying, "The machinery has caught us in its trap." Wilson acknowledges that they can't stop now. Everyone's too curious to see if the gadget will really work. When Oppenheimer asks him how he feels, Wilson admits that even he is caught up in the excitement. Oppenheimer decrees that the test must go on as scheduled. He's already met with the people in Washington to discuss targets. And in a really effective moment, both musically and dramatically, Oppenheimer matter-of-factly lists the Japanese target cities. And the chorus repeats them in a dreamy, slow-motion whisper. They sound like ghosts. Teller muses that actual combat use might be the only way to convince the world that another war would be disastrous, but Wilson disagrees. Oppenheimer quotes the Secretary of War from the Interim Committee. "We should seek to make a profound psychological impression on as many inhabitants as possible." The chorus recites the text of Szilard's petition, but Oppenheimer points out that security officials will see to it that the document never reaches the president anyway. Teller closes the scene with a dire rumination. The more decisive a weapon is, the more surely it will be used, and no agreements will help. Could we have started the atomic age with clean hands? Scene two offers us a completely different mood. It's the bedroom of Oppenheimer and his wife, Kitty. He's busy studying reports and is lost in concentration. She tries to get his attention with a poem by Muriel Rukeyser. It begins with the tease, "Am I in your light?" This is a beautiful moment musically. It's serene, quiet, gentle, intimate. And it gets even better. When Kitty gives up, he finally responds to her with an incredibly romantic and sensuous poem by Baudelaire. But then he leaves her. She finishes the scene with the following. "Those who most long for peace now pour their lives on war. Our conflicts carry creation and its guilt. These years' great arms are full of death and flowers. A world is to be fought for, sung, and built. Love must imagine the world." Throughout the opera, Kitty's text is poetry by Rukeyser, and a lot of Oppenheimer's text is Baudelaire. Oppenheimer adored Baudelaire's poetry so much that supposedly he always kept a small volume of it in his pocket. Scene three takes us to the night of the test, out in the New Mexico desert. Groves and Oppenheimer are conferring with the head meteorologist, Frank Hubbard. It's storming. Lightning is threatening to strike the gadget, and rain is soaking the electrical connections. The worst possible weather for the test. Groves is adamant that the test must go on. The president will be negotiating the fate of Japan with Stalin in the morning. He needs a successful test tonight. Oppenheimer loses himself in a reverie. Quoting a few lines from the Hindu Bhagavad Gita, Oppenheimer was so fascinated by the Bhagavad Gita that when he was a student, he learned Sanskrit just so he could read it in the original language. The text he recites here is eerie in its appropriateness to the situation, the weather, and the impending nuclear test. I am the heat of the sun, and the heat of the fire am I also. Life eternal and death. I let loose the rain or withhold it. Arjuna, I am the cosmos revealed, and its germ that lies hidden. In a fit, Groves threatens to hang Hubbard. Oppenheimer admits that if they postponed, it would be hard to get his people up to pitch again. On the other hand, he's just heard that Enrico Fermi is convinced that if the wind changes, radioactive fallout will cause a catastrophe. As he's talking about the disastrous consequences of the atomic explosion, a curious motif appears in the orchestra. It reminds me of random syncopated ticking, of an unpredictable and out-of-time clock. It's subtle here, and it usually is when it reappears in other parts of the drama, too. It doesn't get a full statement until the very end of the opera, at the point of the explosion. I think of it as the doomsday clock motif. Captain James Nolan of the Army Medical Corps enters and reports on the research that he and his staff have been doing on the toxic properties of the plutonium being used in the bomb. He summarizes the horrific effects it can have on the human body. Morale has him worried, too. Stress has everyone in Los Alamos ready to snap. All this time, Oppenheimer has been continuing to recite sections of the Bhagavad Gita in an attempt to keep himself calm. At this point, the real Oppenheimer weighed less than 100 pounds, chain-smoked as fast as he could roll his cigarettes, and was close to a nervous breakdown. Groves sends the military personnel away, and he and Oppenheimer are left alone to talk. Oppenheimer teases the general about his weight. Unlike Oppenheimer, the real Groves tended to put on weight when under pressure. Groves admits that his weakness for sweets has ruined the diet he was on. He recommends Oppenheimer get a little sleep, and then he goes off to bed himself. Then, in the most beautiful aria of the opera, Oppenheimer reflects on his predicament with a setting of a poem by John Donne, "Batter My Heart, Three-Personed God." Donne was another favorite poet of Oppenheimer's, and it's believed that this sonnet was the inspiration for his naming the New Mexico test site, Trinity. The last stanza best illustrates Oppenheimer's brilliant and conflicted soul. I, like an usurped town, to another do, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me, me should defend, but is captive and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you and would beloved fain, but I am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie, or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except that you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me. And that ends Act One. Act Two begins with another electronic soundscape, this one dominated by snippets of 50s radio music and ominous rumbling. It's still the night of the test, but now we're at Los Alamos in the Oppenheimer's house. Kitty is there with the two children, Peter, who's about 5, and baby Catherine. Pasqualita is there to help with the baby. Here, Kitty sings another Ruckeiser setting, this poem called Easter Eve, 1945. It begins, "Weary of time, oh, it seizes the soul tonight. I wait for the great morning of the West, confessing with every breath mortality. Moon of this wild sky struggles to stay whole, and on the water silvers the ships of war. It's apocalyptic, but there's also a hopeful prophecy in this long, abstract poem. I read that Peter Sellers sees this as the moral of the opera. All shining with life as the leaf, as the wing shines, the stone deep in the mountain, the drop in the green wave. Lit by their energies, secretly all things shine. Nothing can black that glow of life, although each part go crumbling down, itself shall rise up whole. After that, Pascualita sings Baby Catherine, a traditional lullaby from her Tewa Indian culture, the cloud flower lullaby. In the north, the cloud flower blossoms, and now the lightning flashes, and now the thunder clashes, and now the rain comes down. After this scene, Pascualita, Kitty, and the children pass in and out of the action at the test site like spirits. Completely different worlds are superimposed on one another in the same time and space. Scene two is back at the test site. The gadget is ready, and everyone has already left the area except for the weatherman Hubbard and Robert Wilson, who's making one last adjustment to the gadget. They nervously speculate on the damage the fallout could do after the impending explosion, and worry that lightning might set the gadget off while they're right there next to it. Wilson relates a recurring dream he's had about slipping and falling from the bomb tower. At the same time, Pascualita reprises her lullaby. Then Kitty sings another Ruckeiser poem, this one from a collection called Beast in View. Though it was written in 1944, before Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one verse of it is eerily apropos. I hear your cries, you little voices of children, swaying wild, night lost, in black fields calling. I hear you as the seething dreams arrive, over the sea and past the flaming mountains. Pascualita sings her lullaby once more as we move to the base camp, where Groves, Oppenheimer, and Teller wait for the storm to pass so the test can go on. It's almost 3 a.m. Teller brings up the possibility that the test might ignite the atmosphere. He claims Enrico Fermi is taking bets on whether it will be just New Mexico or the whole world that's destroyed. Groves doesn't appreciate Teller's sense of humor and warns him to stop it before he causes a panic. In all seriousness, Teller explains in an extended solo that it's been his job to explore every possible danger. His initial calculations really did indicate that the bomb could spark a worldwide conflagration. Oppenheimer reminds him that his calculations were immediately disproved by another physicist, Hans Bethe. Teller concedes that Bethe was right. But then, there in a rainstorm in the middle of the night, he incorrigibly takes out a bottle of suntan lotion and tells a couple of nervous soldiers that they'd better pass it around. The test is set for 5:30 a.m. Scene three is subtitled Countdown, and it begins with a truly scary-sounding chorus. There's no text, and the melodic line just goes lower and lower until the women drop out, and then the men drop out, and the line continues descending in the low brass of the orchestra. It's 5:10 a.m. The countdown has begun, and everyone is ruminating. Groves complains that there are certain scientists involved in the project who are serious security risks. He alternates with Oppenheimer, who has drifted off in another reverie of more beautiful Baudelaire. This poem is concerned with the nature of time. Oh, yes, time has returned. Now time reigns absolute. Kitty is in the mix, singing another poem by Ruckeiser, and Pascualita begins something new, another Native American story song, this one with a more disturbing text, but again, so right for the situation. Remember, her people were vanquished, and now technology has completely engulfed the land. Word came from a runner, a stranger. They're dancing to bring the dead back in the mountains. We danced at an autumn fire. We danced the old hate and change. The coming again of our leaders, but they did not come. Kitty appears with another Ruckheiser text. Pasqualita fades in and out with more of her story. And Robert Wilson relates his Los Alamos experience with the coincidence of his having recently read Tomas Mann's The Magic Mountain. The real-life Wilson really did make this comparison. Throughout this part of the scene, the chorus is part of the accompaniment. No text, just singing on ah or e. And also throughout, the orchestra hints at what I referred to earlier as the clock motif. As you can tell, the texture, both dramatic and musical, is getting thicker and thicker. Teller mentions that there's a betting pool on the explosive power of the bomb measured in thousands of tons of TNT. It's clear that Oppenheimer and Groves recognize that there's a very good chance of failure, but Teller scoffs that the scientists are afraid to believe their own calculations. Scene 3 ends with a powerful, almost savage chorus that's another one of my favorite musical moments of the opera. The text is from the Bhagavad Gita, a description of the god Vishnu. At the sight of this, your shape stupendous, full of mouths and eyes, feet, thighs and bellies, terrible with fangs, O master, all the worlds are fear-struck, even just as I am. When I see you, Vishnu, omnipresent, shouldering the sky in hues of rainbow, with your mouths agape and flame eyes staring, all my peace is gone. My heart is troubled. This chorus is terrific. Everyone is singing at full volume, the orchestra is blasting, and the percussion pounds away like some elemental force unleashed out of our ancient past. The timpani are especially prominent here, playing a motif that's been foreshadowed earlier in the opera. It's thrilling and terrifying. The final scene, subtitled Countdown Part 2, starts with Groves advising a security officer to keep an eye on Oppenheimer. He's worried that he might have a breakdown at the last minute. Oppenheimer has lost himself in a continuation of the Baudelaire poem he started earlier. It's a powerful aria, ending with, "No, there are no more minutes, no more seconds. Time has disappeared. It is eternity that reigns now." All along, the chorus has been making the sounds of a muttering mass of humanity. A wailing siren snaps Oppenheimer back to reality. It's the 5-minute signal. He shouts for everyone to take their places in the trenches. After a turbulent interlude in the orchestra, an unexpected serenity takes hold. The storm that's been ravaging the test site all night has suddenly dissipated. Hubbard, in an almost disbelieving, trance-like solo, reports that visibility is now better than 60 miles, the wind has died down, and the rain has stopped. This seeming miracle is exactly what happened on the morning of the actual test. Pasqualita relates a final vision, an affirmation, or perhaps an acquiescence, to the unity of all things. In the summer, dreaming was common to all of us, the drumbeat hope, the bursting heart of wish. Music to bind us as the visions streamed and midnight brightened to belief. In the morning, we told our dreams. They were all the same dream. Overlapping Pasqualita's organic wisdom, Wilson, in his own scientific vernacular, contemplates the mystic implications of the work done. The work in the loss of mass, the work in the lifetimes of fixed stars, the work in ideas of instability. Divisible and transmutable as matter, divisible and transmutable as idea. A second, more urgent siren sounds. It's the 2-minute warning. Oppenheimer's last line and the last line of the libretto are the words the real Oppenheimer uttered as he waited for the explosion, and they hearken back to the Batter My Heart aria at the end of Act One. He says simply, "Lord, these affairs are hard on the heart." The orchestra reprises the long, dissonant chord that was first heard in the overture, and when that dies down, we finally get the full iteration of the motif that's only been foreshadowed up to now. The impression of a clock ticking out of time, starting very quietly but getting louder and louder and more out of rhythm until it's unrecognizable. Then the very end is quiet again, and you hear the voice of a Japanese woman. It's a recording of a Hiroshima survivor describing the cries of irradiated children begging for water. And that's how it ends. I mentioned earlier that one might expect an opera about the Manhattan Project to be suspenseful. Whether we dwell on it or just try to put it out of our minds, the Manhattan Project is history, and most of us have known and lived with its ending all of our lives. Perhaps the suspense of Dr. Atomic is the reminder that really, we don't yet know how this story is going to end, because outside the Opera House doors, we're all still living it. Thanks for listening to this commentary on CD, a project of the Women's Board of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and thank you to Nonesuch Records and Warner Brothers Records for providing the musical excerpts of John Adams's Harmonium, Shaker Loops, Nixon in China, and The Death of Klinghoffer. This is Jesse Graham. See you at the opera.